So as I shared, we are beginning this Lenten season looking at the theme and the series, Embracing the Uncertain. And this is based on a book that was written by Reverend McGray DeVega, who's the senior pastor at Hyde Park United Methodist Church. He actually wrote it a few years ago, but like many things that are spiritual, liturgical, theological, we see how the calendar of reality sort of rolls back to the importance of these themes. McGray, of course, I don't think, knew that we would be in a pandemic a few years later. But if you're reading the book, you see how these themes of isolation and uncertainty and, of course, of doubt are as relevant today as they were just a few years ago. Lent, of course, being a season in which we go through a little over 40 days of not only reflecting on ourselves and thinking about our own mortality and the ways that we have strayed from God, but also just those reflections of isolation and the journey that we are on, similar to Jesus' journey those 40 days before he began his public ministry, and then also the journey that he tells his disciples about as they are heading toward the city of Jerusalem, where Jesus will be arrested and crucified. It is a season that is often embodied in struggle and wondering and wandering and searching and reflecting and self-examination, but also examining the world around us. All of this is apparent in McGray's book, and as we read it, it can be easy to assume that this book was written for us right here and right now, because, as we all know, we're facing much more than just a pandemic. In fact, McGray writes in his first chapter, relationships break, discernment fails, confidence falters, fears loom, shame builds, temptations grow, doubt increases. Chaos convenes without notice, even in times of apparent blessing. Uncertainty abounds in our individual lives and in 21st century life. And lurking beneath all of this is one of the few guarantees in life, the reality of our own mortality. Did any of us think we would be facing these realities in our lifetime, any stage of life? You may have noticed that over this last year, we've said goodbye to many of our staff who have just reached that age of, who have reached that age of retirement. Now, a couple of staff have left to go on and pursue other opportunities, but like 99% of them have just reached that time when they are retiring. And we knew this was going to happen. We knew that always it was going to all come to a head, but of course, it's one thing to know it and to expect it. It's a totally other thing to actually go through it and experience it. But one of the things that probably none of us were experiencing, certainly those who are retiring, was to retire in such an uncertain time. We know about some other people who are experiencing that. Because all of us, whether we're retiring or thinking about it or not, all of us are overcapacitated. We are overmaxed. We are overexhausted. We are just all over it. We cannot add one more thing. We cannot make one more decision. We can't take on one more responsibility, and it doesn't seem to be stopping. How much longer, we might be asking. And so we see in the scripture passage today, even Jesus himself asks this question. Right after the transfiguration, when Jesus takes a few of his disciples up to the mountain, and he has this incredible experience. He rises into the air, and his body is just shining, blazing light. They hear the voice of God. And then as Jesus comes back down, he says in the midst of this miracle, by the way, we are now going to go to Jerusalem, where I will be arrested and crucified. And then as he's telling them this, as they go back down to the mountain, he sees the other disciples and a crowd gathering and sort of arguing with each other and with the townspeople. And this is happening in Mark chapter 9. When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. When the whole crowd saw Jesus, they were immediately overcome with awe and they ran forward to greet him. Jesus asked, "What are you all arguing about?" Someone from the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak, and whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do so." Jesus answered them, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be amongst you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to Jesus. When the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to him?" The father said, "From childhood. It has often cast him into the fire, into the water, to destroy him. But if you are able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." Jesus said, "If you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes." Immediately, the father of the child cried out, "I believe. Help my unbelief." This statement, this confession, has been one of the lines of liturgy used more often throughout the centuries. "I believe, help my unbelief." At first glance, this may not make much sense. It may even seem like it's missing a word or two, at least how it's translated into our modern English from ancient Greek. Maybe today it might make more sense if we said something like, "I believe, but help my unbelief." Or maybe more importantly, "I believe and help my unbelief." Or maybe we don't need to add anything at all. Maybe more importantly, these two phrases, these two confessions are side by side because that is how life is. Certainly right now. Our belief coexists with our unbelief, with our doubt. And we see how alive doubt is in this story. It bounces from the disciples to the father to the crowd and then reverberates back to the father and to the disciples to where they're not even sure if even Jesus can do anything. "If you are able," says the father. "If you are able, if, how much longer?" Jesus asks. It's really hard when you experience that person who you have kind of stereotypically seen and valued as the one who keeps a level head, as the one who is peaceful and positive, and then that one day they just kind of snap. We tend to stereotype Jesus as this Prince of Peace all the time, this teacher who is always positive and always loving and always emotionally balanced. And then when his temper flares, it is really uncomfortable. Does this mean that Jesus is losing his faith in humanity? Does even Jesus doubt? And is that so bad? McGray goes on to write, "We spend so much of our formative years acquiring knowledge to dispel uncertainty." And this is kind of who we have become as a post-Enlightenment culture, this idea that we amass knowledge in the midst of all of these beliefs we're told that we're supposed to have. He goes on to write, "Every time we learn something, we add it to an ever-widening foundation upon which we can frame our existence." Now, please hear me say, there is nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with learning and with education. It is vital to life. But I think the question that we need to ask is, why are we learning? What are we learning for? What are we amassing knowledge for? Because how life-giving is it to just learn and to acquire knowledge simply for the defense against uncertainty? Is it life-giving to learn for the security to know all there is and thus be protected from that uncertainty instead of learning so that we may go deeper? So that we may experience more, even if it is more uncertainty. I mean, how many times have we heard a very respected, wise, sage-like person say, perhaps in a time of confession or even celebration, "You know, the more I learn, the less I know." We are often taught that doubt and faith are at opposite ends of the spectrum, and that they are constantly in conflict with each other. And unfortunately, that oftentimes spills into our faith life and our faith journeys. And thus doubt gets painted in this negative light as though it was wrong for us to doubt. Or even worse, to doubt is a sign of weakness. What does it mean to believe? In our modern Western culture, it seems to oftentimes be portrayed as this thing that we are supposed to know and thus what we are supposed to defend. As though instead of believe, we focus more on belief. That we focus more on the noun rather than the verb. And there is a huge difference. See, when we focus on the verb, it is a way of life. It is an embodiment. It is who we are and what we do, not this thing that we have to explain and analyze and articulate so that we can defend it, so that we can be secure from the uncertainties of the world. But if we need to add language, if we need to put a little bit of English into this ancient Greek, maybe we don't just need conjunctions. Maybe we also need prepositions. So that in order to believe, instead, maybe we focus on how we beloved. We beloved of God. We trust in God. We struggle with God. And perhaps even we doubt for God. If we have the ability to doubt, might this be a way that we experience God's presence? Perhaps through doubt of what we thought, the way things were, the way they were supposed to be, we are able to see God in a way we have not seen God before. Perhaps doubt is that path to transformation and to resurrection. Think of the story of Jacob. Jacob spends all of this time running from his brother Esau, all because of this stupid blessing that they both thought was so important. And that one night, Jacob finds that mysterious figure. It might be an angel, it might be a spirit, it might have been God incarnate. Whatever it was, Jacob decides not only to wrestle with this creature, but also to ask for a blessing. Again, with the blessing. But instead of getting a blessing, the being says to him, "You're going to get a new name instead. You will be offered transformation. You will be offered resurrection. And a busted hip in the process." Because sometimes when we go through transformation, we continue to struggle with it. Or what about the most famous doubter in the gospel, Thomas? Was Thomas rejected by Jesus because he doubted? He was embraced. He was embraced in the midst of uncertainty, in the midst of doubt. And because he was embraced in the midst of his doubt, that's when he was able to declare, to articulate, to express, "My Lord and my God." If we are honest about our doubt, no, if we're not honest about our doubt, where do we have left to go? But if we express our doubt, if we share our doubt, if we embrace our doubt, if we embrace the uncertain, that can be a path forward. Now, it may not be an easy path. It may not be a straight path, but it is an open path. As we have come to the table today, we realize that our path may venture back away from it. But we will be invited again and again and again and again. The question we have to ask ourselves is, are we willing to continue to walk through, even when we are walking through seasons and valleys of doubt? Because to stay there, then the journey ends. But if we can continue to walk through, we will experience that we are not alone, that God continues not only to walk with us, but also to lead us out. Let us embrace the uncertain, not only this Lenten season, but as we move forward in whatever the future brings. Know that God continues to walk with us so that we might be led out, but also that we might share these gifts with the world to others who are struggling. There is nothing wrong with doubt. There is nothing weak about doubt, because it is through doubt that we transform and we resurrect and we celebrate that wonderful miracle of Easter. We will get there. Let us get there together, and let us go in peace. Amen.